I think Duncan.
All right, Uncas McFamia part two.
I remember that it was a wonderful thing. I sat around the house for, I would have been met with Charlie and John and Em and Aunt, all the family and the grandchildren, and just sort of sat in the house just to find her spirit and to listen to them for 2 days before the funeral. And so I just sort of sat around like I was a fly on the wall, and they were all talking and doing one thing or another and grieving the way people do, and you know, moving furniture around and that kind of stuff. And so I just kind of listened and began to hear sort of her talking amongst all those grandchildren. And so, you know, at the funeral, there wasn't anything to do but tell stories. And so I said, you know, we better get on about what we're supposed to do. And you know, we're here to celebrate the life of a double-dulled, camel-smoking Democrat who used to lie about the Washington Redskins or something like that. And it was a really important way for me and for them, I think, to deal with the kind of grief and stuff. And I just thought it was, I got all kinds of letters from grandchildren and people in the family and friends who were there saying that it was just the right thing to say about Catherine. And I'm sure I have a copy of it somewhere, but I know there's a copy over in the archives. And it was a, it was probably the best thing I've ever written, as a matter of fact.
Well, I'm going to have to track that down. That sounds really, I hope somebody remembers me in a eulogy like that.
Well, it was, it was a way, because she was a, really was a wonderful woman. And
well, you know, I'm kind of intrigued at this notion in this supposedly all-male school where women's opinions weren't very much valued in those days. And yet, here she was, running the place.
I think it was the way, if I were a sociologist, I would say there are two things operating. One is, I think that's the way women have always subverted the world, and you got to subvert it if you're going to control it and make it a more humane place. And second, she had a real sort of tea and sympathy function for students who were dissolute, strung out. She always knew how to make them care about themselves even when they didn't, in ways that men couldn't in an all-male environment. But it's both those points, I think. One is the tea and sympathy, but the other is she had to subvert the place to make it be more human. She would, you know, you'd get somebody who didn't have high LSAT scores or something else, she'd go in and sweet talk the dean and say, well, this is a wonderful young man, or whatever, you ought to have, you need him. You know, she'd do things that way. And I think that's probably, my guess is there are other women doing the same thing to humanize this place.
Do you know of any others?
I've heard, but I didn't know. I know she ran the place, but I don't know how humanizing she was. It was Ms. Varner, and she was Lou Adams' secretary in the Commerce School. They called him Curly Lou Adams, and she, her husband was in the treasurer's office. And I know, in fact, she ran the school, but I don't know with an iron hand or a velvet glove or how. But she was one of those people of power.
All right, I'll track stories about her. So let's get back to old Uncas McThenia, or young Uncas McThenia.
Right.
He's a student, and he goes off and practices. How'd he get back here as a member of the faculty?
I was in Alexandria. Bob Huntley had left here when he went to practice law with Booth, Armstead Booth, who was a kind of a famous anti-bird machine Democrat in Virginia. It was a small law firm in Alexandria. Back in them were good small law firms. And I had left here to practice law in Washington. It was a serious mistake in my professional life. I'd gone with a small antitrust firm, and I was just as useless as that television without the cord plugged in, because you don't know anything at that age. And I was very bored, not very fulfilled, and started looking around. And Bob Huntley got word of that and got word back to that law firm, because I had talked to them when I was in law school, but they hadn't decided to hire anybody. And they offered me a job, and it was in Alexandria, and we liked Alexandria, and so I went to work there. And he used to stop in from time to time to see the law firm. And I'd see him, and he was teaching here at the time. And somewhere along the line, I guess they decided they needed another law teacher, and called me, and they had the loyalty to the law firm. They called them and said they were going to call me. And they called me and said, would you be interested? And I thought about it a while. And I think I was probably ready to come within a month after they asked me. But Ann wasn't, so she'd begun to, all our kids had been born in Alexandria, or two of them had been born. She'd been developing a life there, and she was interested in that. And wasn't until some months later that she decided if I wanted to make a move, she was ready to make it. But they, so I did decide, and she said, well, I'll go with you. And that's how we came down here. That was in 67. Yeah.
So how was that, coming back to a place where you had been a student? How did your now former teachers, now colleagues, receive you?
Oh, much more graciously and warmly than they should have. They all thought I knew something. It wasn't my first experience teaching here. So my old mentor, when I'd been a student here, is the guy who first hired me to teach when I was in college. My friend and advisor, Marcella Stowe, had a heart attack. I think it was a stroke. Anyway, he was disabled and could not teach. And the other guy was a two-person department of geology. The other guy had left to go off to Texas. And Ed Spencer, do you know Ed?
Mm-hmm.
Ed had just been hired to teach geology, and he came down here thinking he was going to be the new guy in a two-person department, and he's one guy in a one-person department because the chairman is dying. And so he hired me to teach when I was a senior in college, teach a course in mineralogy, one I'd had just the year before or something. And they were really desperate. So I taught in the fall of 1957, I taught at Washington. Yeah, the fall of 1957, the spring of 1958, and I was a student. I taught a mineralogy course, and then I taught freshman lab second semester. So I'd had some.
Was that extraordinary?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean,
I've never heard of such a thing.
It shouldn't have happened. I mean, they were absolutely desperate. They all had been fired from malpractice. But they couldn't get anybody else, you know. In those days, geologists were making money. The oil industry was cranked up. And they just couldn't find anybody to do it, I expect. And didn't have any time. I think Ed Spencer got here, and Dr. Stowe had a heart attack the next day or something like that. So anyway, Ed or somebody hired me to teach the fall of 57 and the spring of 58 while I was a student. And that's why I didn't play football my senior year. I was doing that. So when I came to teach in the law school, I had been in that world once before, but, you know, in a much different way. But my former teachers were really, you know, they were really helpful. Bill Ritz was very helpful. Charles, everybody was helpful. trying to show me what to do, and Lash LaRue came at the same time. You know Lash?
Mm-hmm. I know Sue.
Yeah, well, he and I came at the same time. And he had somebody what he was doing. I didn't have any damn idea what I was doing. Because my experience had been so limited in terms of, you know, I'd gone to law school here and I'd practiced law and come back here. You know, he'd gone to Harvard Law School and had, you know, just a much broader kind of base of experience. But I found everybody very helpful to me, and, you know, we used to make plenty of mistakes.
What kind of mistakes?
Well, part of it was being young, making brash political moves, you know. I won't say anybody else, but I used to make those kind of mistakes. You know, thinking if we didn't do it, never been done before, you know how you are when you're young. But everybody always forgave those on the faculty. And made a lot of mistakes as a teacher. I mean, I felt like a failure more days than I felt like success. Had no idea what I was doing. So there was those, just basically those kind of mistakes, like thinking you're a hot shot and you could run the place better than those people who'd been here were doing. But everybody was always very forgiving about that. And then mistakes as a teacher, thinking you know something when you don't. And you learn what a good teacher is when you have to do it. And there's somebody who just kind of stays about 6 inches ahead of you. Because if you stay a foot ahead of somebody, they don't run the race anymore. And if you stay even with them, they're smarter than you are. So you just gotta work, just throw the hay out there where people won't quite get it, but they can get it if they work hard enough. And, I mean, you learn through mistakes. And it's I don't understand how law schools and universities have survived hiring people who are so absolutely and abysmally ignorant of the whole process of how people learn. But, you know, they do, and we all, I guess, have been doing it for hundreds of years. So it was a difficult couple of years for me. It wasn't until I'd been doing this for about 3 years that I decided that's what I was going to do. Yeah.
And this was back in Tucker Hall, right?
Mm-hmm.
So was it, as a faculty member, did you begin to realize what I guess was being realized in general, the limitations of Tucker Hall? And
I began to realize that there were other visions that could be, it was not only the limitations of Tucker Hall spatially, but the limitations of Tucker Hall in terms of a vision of what a law school could be.
Tell me about that.
I think the law school had gotten probably fairly complacent, hadn't thought of challenging itself or its students significantly. You get a lot of older guys who were tired and ready to retire. There were no role models much for young people, young faculty to say, you know, you ought to be doing this, or here's some other way to look at life. And I think Bob Huntley saw that, but he didn't have time, sort of being the acting president. He wasn't the president, he wasn't even acting president, but he was, in effect, he was doing an awful lot of that. I don't think he had the time to develop young people the way he thought they ought to be mentored. And he was probably the only one. Charles tried, and Charles was helpful, always helpful, but he was never really a mentor. He was a mentor, but he wasn't a mentor in intellectual ways so much for me as he was a few years later, I think, for Mark Grunewald, because they taught in the same subject area. Mark taught labor law. But the school was, I think, had about outgrown the space, and it also, the space had been confining on letting new thoughts in and new kind of concepts of what a law school might be. And I don't mean this in the sense that somehow we changed it when we came in young, but it may have been at a fairly low point in the law school's history.
Well, I found myself thinking that as we were talking about these older teachers. It was pretty much older guys.
Oh, yeah.
And so this was a changing of the guard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that.
Well, all of a sudden it developed that way because Charlie McDowell died, Skinny Williams died, Charles did not teach. No, Charles taught in this building, Charles Law. So it was, in some ways it was that. There was, Lash and I came at the same time, then the next year Joe Ulrich came. And the next year, Roger Groot came. So suddenly, well, within 10 years, I was the second oldest guy on the faculty. And then Bill Stewart died, and I was the oldest. And that's been 10, 15 years. So it was a complete turnover. Women came in 73. I think it was 73.
As students or as faculty or both?
As students. And Sally was on the staff and as a student as well. First women teachers, I don't think, came until 76 or 7. Even 8, but it was a changing of the guard. And then 68, probably 69, Roy Steinheimer came as the dean, and he did something nobody else has ever done. He did everything well. Most deans have to carve out something they're going to do, like, you know, raise the flag or get students or build a building. Roy did all those things well. And one of the things he did very well is he recruited students. He'd get in his airplane, he'd fly out all these little old colleges like Washington Lee, small schools. I mean, he went to a lot of places, but he knew how to mine for students, because so he'd go to schools that were not unlike Washington Lee. A lot of them in the Midwest, like Hope College, Calvin College. Let me just take that 1 second.
Sure.
But he got a place like Albion, Davidson in the South. But he got a lot of small schools and recruit. And we got at Colgate. We got to be a point where we'd pick off the number 1, 2, or 3 students from a lot of those small schools. And so we increased rapidly the intellectual capability of the top end of the class. It was always a small segment of very bright people, but he increased that, took out some of the elasticity in the class. Prior to that time, you had some very smart people and some people who probably ought to have been doing some other things going to law school. And it shortened that, took the elasticity out, so you had more people at the top and the middle, and some of the people who had been applying to you before didn't apply or we didn't accept them. And that, Roy did that really quickly and in a hurry and did it well. He also began almost immediately to start trying to plan for an increased size of the facility. He started unlocking money to hire, to get additional faculty.
What do you mean unlocking money?
Getting the law school to, I mean, getting the university to allocate money to the law school. My guess is that for a good number of years, the law school had been a stepchild to the college and to the whole administration, the whole university. My guess is it hadn't gotten, I know the salaries weren't competitive with what they were at other law schools. It hadn't been active in recruiting students. It had sort of assumed that it would take people who applied from the college. And Roy got more money, began to get a bigger pool of students, and we didn't take everybody from the college. That made a lot of people mad. Recruited faculty, began to think about additional geographic space, began to help us as faculty, young faculty. He would act as a mentor in a lot of ways. He'd sort of get money together to send you off somewhere to a conference or support you in your research and those kind of things. And he had, it's largely because he was such an incredibly easy administrator, that is, he could do it so well, and he had had the experience of having been at the University of Michigan, so he had his own set of credentials he came here with, and he bargained when he came here, not just with the president for the job, but he went back out and bargained with Ross Malone, who was by then general counsel to General Motors. So before he took the job, he bargained with Bob Huntley, and they may have struck a deal, I don't know, but I know before he announced, he went out and talked to Ross Malone at GM, and probably got some promises out of Ross Malone, who was on the trustees, board of trustees of Washington at the time. In fact, this may have been the rector of the board, I don't know.
Promises? What kind of promises?
I don't know, but my guess is, I don't know that he got any promises, but the fact is that what was significant was that he was negotiating with a member of the board, and Huntley was free enough, felt free enough himself to let him do that. And so it was not just, I'm the president, I'm going to hire a law dean, and I'll report to the board of trustees. It was, I'm a president, I'm going to either hire a law dean or not hire him, but I'm going to get the advice, and he can strike some conversation with it. With our most important trustee. And so I don't know if he got any promises, but he got some freedom that way.
So, and who was this trustee?
Ross Malone had been president of the American Bar Association and had been a lawyer in Roswell, New Mexico. And when GM got in a lot of trouble in 1965 or 6 with antitrust violations, they needed an establishment lawyer to head up the legal department, and they went out and hired Ross Malone.
Okay.
As general counsel.
So.
Who was a graduate of the school.
Is he still alive?
No, he's dead now. And there's a room downstairs called the Malone Room, which is a practicing lawyer's room in the library. He's dead, and been dead 15, 20 years, I think.
So, once Steinheimer came here, he worked in concert with Bob Huntley?
Oh, yeah.
And I presume Bob Huntley's heart was still somewhat in the law school. So tell me about that, how that worked.
Oh, it was known as the Bob and Roy show, that every time Steinheimer wanted something, he'd usually get it. And Huntley would spend a lot of time. They were good friends, spent a lot of time together. And for us in law school, it was just a jewel because, if there was ever a legitimate request, Roy would see that it was made to the president, and if he thought it was a good request, he'd fight hard for it. And he never told anybody anything but the truth. I think he is institutionally incapable of lying. He always shot straight with you. No, that's a bad idea, I won't do it. If he'd get mad at you, you'd have a fight, and he'd fight like hell, and it was over in 5 minutes, it was done. I mean, it was history. didn't know how to carry a grudge. My experience, and he got mad at me on more than one occasion. He was an extraordinary man, still is, but he was an extraordinary dean. I don't know anybody except maybe the most alienated who didn't have full trust in him. And he always, if you did something he didn't like, if you tried to push him, he'd give you a promise, I'll do yes, what you want. And he'd do exactly what he promised, but he'd drag his feet so long. One time we were a bunch of hotshot young guys, and we'd been off to the recruiting conference to hire some new faculty or something, and we'd met somebody we thought was just, you know, the home run hitter of the year or something. You ought to go hire this person, or you ought to get in touch with these people right now. He said, I'll do that. Thank you very much for coming to tell me about it. And so he did precisely what he said he'd do. He sat down and wrote them each letter because we wanted to make phone calls. But he didn't lie. But pretty clear he knew who was going to control things, and we weren't going to push him so far. But he was a really wonderful teacher and a wonderful leader, and he made you feel good about what you were doing and always was interested in what you were doing. Tried to be gruff and brusque, and you know, you could see through him if you tried. Students never saw through him, but you could see through him in a hurry. That he was a really warm-hearted guy, and Sue LaRue used to. We were young, all of us doing stupid things. And they got Roy in a car one day, and.
Hello, I'm sorry.
Hey.
I didn't quite
get that story, though.
I don't remember where we were.
He was getting in a car.
Oh, yeah. So, Roy's been here 3 or 4 years and had never registered to vote. And Ann and Sue were in the League of Women Voters, and we were young jerk faculty, Flash and I. And they came up to law school one day. We were still in Tucker Hall. And said, Dean Steinheimer, we want to talk to you. And he, after the fact, said he thought they wanted to talk about their husband's salaries. And so he decided he'd listen. And he said, we want you to go with us. And he said, all right. Didn't ask any questions. They got him in the car, opened the door, and put him in the back seat. And they drove him down to the voter registration desk and got him registered to vote. He never figured out what would happen. He didn't know how to deal with a woman. I mean, he had a wonderful wife. He's got a wonderful wife now, his first wife died. But he had no children, so he had no notion of how you stand up to women or what you do with them or anything else. That's one reason Catherine ran the law school so effectively. But when the first women came to the law school, Roy was absolutely powerless. And anything they asked for, he'd give it to them. There was a faculty bathroom on the second floor. And I don't know where the women's bathroom was. Maybe there was one of them on the second floor. I don't know how they crabbed all those bathrooms together, but in any event, the women decided they wanted the faculty bathroom because it had more room in it, and women needed the couch. Menstrual periods. Well, they went down, women students went down and confronted Roy with that, and he didn't know what to do. So he said, take it right now. So in a quick hurry, he converted the faculty bathroom. And women he just didn't know how to handle them. So that the only people who ever beat him in negotiation were women students.
So what happened among the male faculty when these women came in, these women students, these women faculty eventually came in, and he's letting them have whatever they want? Was there any resentment? It was funny.
I don't perceive as any resentment, no. He just, he It was funny, it was what ought to be done, but he just didn't know how to, that's the only thing he didn't know how to do gracefully. And he'd just cave in every time. But it was always usually a question of justice.
Yes, of course, women were only asking for reasonable things, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, sure. But, you know, most people would find an excuse not to give it to them. Roy didn't have to do that. I didn't. Sally would know. She was a student and a staff person in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But my perception is that he made that transition work very well. He wouldn't fight the fight to get women admitted. But once it happened, he made it happen right.
And what's your impression of why it happened?
American Bar Association said you're in trouble. If you don't let it happen, if it doesn't happen.
It's a pretty definitive reason, isn't it? They got a lot of clout. So, all right. All that happened in Tucker Hall. Women started coming to Tucker Hall. Then there was this big event. How did this building come to be? Was it the Bob and Roy show?
Well,
how did Sidney and Frances get into this whole thing?
Bob was in negotiations with them. The way I hear the story, and I think I've heard this accurately, and I think I've heard from Frank and from Huntley himself, and maybe even Roy, but my memory of the story that I heard, I know it's my memory, and I think it's been told to me by more than one person, is they went to see Sidney and Frances. And they were going to go ask them to endow a professorship. And Frances or Sidney said, well, what would you think of $9 million toward a building? And Huntley said, you sure do drive a hard bargain. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I've heard that story.
And
it's the kind of thing that would be said.
And did they determine that it would be the law school?
Mm-hmm.
It was the Lewises who said they wanted...
I think they expressed a lot of interest in the law school, because Sidney had been a student in the law school. Yeah, and he had been one of Charles Laughlin's students. When the gift was announced to the faculty, Roy announced the gift, Charles immediately went back and found him on his old seating chart.
And there he was.
There he was.
So, speaking of Laughlin and Tucker Hall and Lewis Hall, one of the things that you made reference to in your eulogy for Charles Laughlin is his address on the farewell to Tucker Hall. Will you describe that scene? I haven't gotten the address yet. Oh, that's right, you were gone.
Yeah, I was in Toronto when
Oh, that's right, you were gone. I got to get that address. I've got feelers out getting to get a copy of it.
It was in the alumni bulletin.
It was?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Catherine's was not, but somebody, they wanted to put it in there, but it was not ever, did it appear. But it was in the alumni bulletin.
The farewell to Tucker Hall was?
No, I'm sorry.
Your eulogy. Yeah, I've got that. But I want to get the farewell to Tucker Hall address.
I don't know. I've seen it, but I don't know where.
Well, I've got feelers out. We'll find it.
Might be in the old law news.
So you weren't here for the actual move?
Mm-mm.
You missed the party?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, Lord,
I was here right here when we got in, not to move over, but
were you here for the whiskey party?
Yeah, that whiskey. Yeah.
All right, tell me about the party.
Well, it was a hell of a party. It was you've heard how the story this came.
Tell me the story.
Okay, the story was that Alec Harmon, who was on the Supreme Court of Virginia, was an old bachelor, still is an old bachelor, and you might want to talk to him. He spends his winters in Florida and his summers in Hiawassee, which is down near Lake New River Country, Crater Lake somewhere. But Alec Harmon dealt in Scotch futures as one of his investments. So he had some Scotch in Scotland in smoked kegs, or whatever kind of, you know, burnt kegs. And so when the law school came about, he and I were in touch pretty much for a lot of those years, because he was on the Constitutional Revision Commission when I was a young teacher here, and I was the lawyer to the one branch of the commission, the executive and state government branch of the commission. So he was the member of the commission. He and another guy were members of the commission, and I was their lawyer. And so he talked about that a lot, about the dedication. And he decided that it ought to be like the Jockey John Robinson dedication of Robinson Hall, when they all got to drinking whiskey with all these Presbyterians around Rockbridge County and fell out and fought, apparently, on the first front campus. That was the myth of the 1840s, anyway. So he decided he was going to make sure that this law school was dedicated right, in the Jockey John Robinson fashion, with 10 cups. So he had this scotch, got sent to Norfolk, and they had to unkeg it and put it in bottles to get it through customs. As soon as it got through customs, they put it back in the keg and brought to Rockbridge County and had it here for the dedication with those 10 cups. And the keg is still in the building. It's now, I found it in the basement about 2 years ago, and got the staff in the library. I wanted to put it out here in this alcove out in the hall, but they have it downstairs in the rare book room now. Because it was down there, it needed to be swelled up again. If I had been more conniving, I would have stolen it and taken it home. But now I wanted it on show, so it is now on display. but that's the story. And so Alec gave the scotch and gave the 10 cups.
So how many people were here? Did alumni from far and wide come
back?
Yeah,
there seemed to be a really large crowd. I'm not sure they were here to see the law school so much as they were to see Elizabeth Taylor, who was married to John Warner in those days. And she was here and very much on display. And all the speaking took place out there on the softball field. And there was a podium set up. And we were sitting up this way, and the podium was down about where third base is. But it was a beautiful spring day, and several good speeches. Huntley was eloquent, of course. It was the best speech Roy Steinheimer ever made, but it was the worst speech of the day, because he just wasn't a public speaker. But he outdistanced himself that time. But there were there was some real eloquence there. I guess that was 77.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe it was, because it was right around when I moved here, which was 77, and those 10 cups were absolutely everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't smart enough to get invited to the party.
Yeah. That was some spring, 77.
So how did life change coming over here?
We had to work hard to make this place a community. That really was hard work. You had to think about that. I mean, Tucker Hall, you were just, you know, you're bumping up against people all the time. You heard things you didn't want to hear. You were too much of a community. Here, we were on this floor. There were, 200 students scattered around the rest of the building. So it was very difficult. It would have been easy to retreat into some patterns that would have overtaken you and would have been very unhealthy. But we worked hard to kind of make it a community by making students come up here. Several of us began just to put stuff outside our office doors.
What kind of stuff?
Well, assignment stuff, you know. Instead of putting stuff out in the library desk or somewhere, you put stuff outside your door so you make students come by. We used to have, we did work some. We used to have coffee on downstairs on Sundays. And then the building, the flow of the building sort of began to take over and made it a community. Steinheimer saw to it that students got to claim the softball field out here. Started having kegs of beer here on Friday afternoon. I don't know.
Who participated in that? Faculty and students?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That sounds like a community.
Well, it was. Mm-hmm. A very mm-hmm. conscious effort at that for a while. And then, it doesn't have to happen forever.
So it would stop?
It wouldn't stop. I mean, it just doesn't, you don't be conscious about it. Now,
mm-hmm.
those people who are young enough to drink beer go there now. I don't much. I just, it's too tiresome.
So there was a big effort to have community here. How about the facility itself? I presume it was a huge improvement.
Huge improvement. It was, it was a real danger that people get lost for the first year or two because we had the same number of students, same number of faculty, but three times as many square feet. But then nice things happened, like glitches, like, the roof leaked, and people would laugh about that. It'd kind of keep you honest. And then the student body size began to increase. We got up to what we wanted. Faculty increased sort of slowly. Things just kind of rocked along. I mean, we were just lucky. And we worked hard at it.
What about the shift over here to this side of Woods Creek? Was there a sense of isolation? Or was it welcome, or was it a loss? How did people perceive that?
I think both ways. There was a sense of isolation, but there was also a sense of mission. We were doing something interesting and neat. We began to find our own voice independent of, being a part of a larger faculty. That's when we became a separate faculty, really. There was some resentment because A, we got more money, and B, we had bigger facilities, and C, we had air conditioning and those kind of things. Students tended to be never as plugged into the whole system, and because we were getting more and more students who had undergraduate careers at Lehigh or Colgate or Princeton or somewhere else, and they weren't as plugged into the what went on across the ravine. And we made some efforts. I think we thought we lost a whole lot more than we lost. Because we, soon after that happened, I think it was after, the college went on a different calendar anyway, a radically different calendar. They went on the 12-12-6. So we were, I don't know how soon after, it tends to blend into years past for me, I don't remember. But when I was younger, I thought we had lost more than we really did lose in terms of connections. At least that's my perception now.
Do younger faculty members coming in now, do they get involved with the rest of the university?
I think so, yeah. I do think so. I know that many of them do. David Caudill, Sean. Sean's been here 11 years now.
Who's Sean?
Joan Shaughnessy.
Oh, Joan Shaw.
I think they do tend to get involved with folks over there, particularly, I know that women have, women faculty, and I know that some younger faculty have some Some less so, but I think they probably have through newcomers and stuff. And that's continued. Some folks do significant work with people on the undergraduate campus. But after a while, when you get to be old and gray-headed, you don't go to many functions anyway, so you never know. I see all these strange faces. I don't know who they are.
Well, believe me, I know the feeling. I'm going to flip the tape over real quick.